Here in Seaside, we love our beach. There's nothing better than exploring along the sand and breathing that fresh Oregon coast air. We try to keep the beach clean for all to enjoy. That's why this year, we're rewarding all you unsung helpers out there with beach cleanup coins, redeemable on the dollar at local coffee shops in Seaside. It's our way of saying thank you for doing a little good while having a lot of fun. To learn more and get your free travel guide, visit seasideor.com. Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show. Last week, my guest, Anthony Effinger, and I talked about why Portland's population is shrinking. And the pod got quite a bit of mail about it. The most we've ever gotten, in fact. First of all, thank you. I love it. I love engaging. I love it. I love it. I love it. Second of all, whoa. We are passionate about this city. Oh my God. So it feels very correct that this week's cover package is 26 Reasons to Love Portland. And my guest is not a commentator, but a lifelong Portlander on a quest to make sure that we have the tools that we need in order to look out for each other. It's Saturday, February 10th, and this is episode 110 of The Dive. I contributed a couple of blurbs to this week's cover package, as did a good half dozen other writers, but I must confess, when the pitch call came in for this issue and I was asked what I loved about Portland and what I'd like to contribute, my first reaction was, nothing. Me and Portland are fighting right now, and I am not writing love letters to her. She's too much drama. And it's reactionary. I know. I always have something to say about Portland. But my love, I feel like my love kind of excludes cultural trends. Because the city's always going to grow, and it's always going to change, and it's going to fail, and it's going to flourish. That shit's like water. It's moving. It's changing. It's whatever. But there's something else to this place. You know? It's the sparkling mist against my skin when I'm walking on the waterfront. It's the sweet, mossy way that Forest Park smells during mud season. It's double rainbows, sun showers, ice storms, daffodils. It's individuals, like my guest today, Ellen Worship, whose Project Red exists not only to help save lives, but also to destigmatize addiction and support community. And I'll have Ellen explain how Project Red is saving lives and supporting community in just one moment. But first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. Oregon House Democrats are pushing for a statewide ban on flavored tobacco after a circuit court judge blocked Washington County's prohibition. House Bill 3090 would ban the sale of flavored vapes, chewing tobacco, and menthol cigarettes. Ooh, Lord. Sophie Peel reports that 30 low-income residents of North Portland's iconic Rosemont Court are suing their nonprofit landlords, Northwest Housing Alternatives, and the firm Income Property Management, after the waterborne Legionnaire's disease contaminated their building's water supply, sickening 14 tenants and killing one. Jay Horton reports that AMP, the Artist Mentorship Program, will be taking over the Old Town's Brody Theater and will operate kind of like a community center for homeless youths between the ages of 15 and 25. And it'll be a community center as well as a space for visual art, music production, and even performance. Congratulations, AMP. Now let's discuss Project Red with its founder, Ellen Worship.
From my own personal experience, I've lost a lot of friends to opiate overdoses. This time around, after I had been sober a little over, well, longer than a year, I found out that a good friend of mine who actually used to hang out with in high school, and we used to like go to parks and party and things like that, I found out that she had died from an opiate overdose. And it was very hush-hush. It was really quiet. Parents and family didn't want people to know, which on the one hand, I totally understand. So I just had all of this anger that I didn't know was grief underneath, and I didn't know what to do with it. And so I was just sharing with a good friend of mine who does a ton of mutual aid work, like what would be the mutual aid side of getting Narcan into the hands of as many people as possible. And then I realized that the easiest way, or maybe not even the easiest way, but the best way to put it in the hands of business owners, restaurants, bars, strip clubs, coffee shops, music venues, mm-hmm. those places specifically where they might see the most public drug consumption, right? A lot of people tend to use privately in their own homes, and there's not much you can do in that situation except to teach better, you know, never use alone, try to stagger your use if you're with other people. There are hotlines you can call if you're using. And so my thought was just, put it in bars, put it in restaurants, put it in businesses where they have bathroom doors that lock, that, you know,
yeah,
you might have our drug consumption in. And so then I started Project Red through the Alano Club of Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been great since then. I'm, you know,
yeah,
as that kind of work can be.
Thank you for sharing that with me, first of all.
Yeah, of course.
I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into how both addiction and recovery have affected your own life.
Totally. My addiction was, I guess the way I want to say this is, I knew I had a problem before I knew I could stop. And so, you know, I started consuming substances at a really young age, you know, early high school years. And it made me feel comfortable in spaces with other people, and it was fun. And you know, there's this idea that like you'll never recreate your first high, you know, and a lot of people chase that feeling. Yeah. or chase that like first feeling, and it went downhill pretty quickly. I got sober the first time when I was 17, and didn't make it very long, and then had to go back out and do a little more research. But I very much struggled with the drug consumption side of, I know this is a problem. I know that like, and then I just couldn't stop, you know. It took years and years after realizing that it was something that I was struggling with and couldn't have any control over before I could actually get sober. And so when I did, you know, I think when I was in active addiction, there were all these thoughts of like, you know I'm a good person, but I don't know how to be one. You know, mm-hmm. I know I want to make a difference. I want to do something for my community, but I don't know how when I'm stuck in this cycle. Yeah. So when I got out of it, I don't look at the death of my friend and many of my fallen comrades as an opportunity to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, it just coincided that, like, you know, I lost someone and she worked in the restaurant industry. I worked in the restaurant industry. I worked in the restaurant industry through heavy active addiction and through heavy drug consumption and alcohol consumption. And then when I got sober, I stayed in that industry because I wanted to prove that I could. And I wanted to, you know, that was all the job that I had known through my adult life. You know, I kept losing people in this industry, you know?
So is it safe to say that Project Red is geared toward, I think my impression was that it was outwardly geared toward patrons of these establishments, like the idea of, you know, a bathroom with a door that locks, you know, you have to be able to navigate that. But talking to you now, is there also the ulterior, or is the other side of that, like, we also need to be protecting the people that we work with that are in active addiction?
Totally. One of the reasons that I really love to do full staff trainings where we get to sit down and have like a 30-minute, 40-minute, you know, a Q&A, and I run people through how to use Narcan, is that that information is applicable to all people. It's not just going to be necessary, although it will be important if somebody is experiencing an overdose on your premises. But I also want to allow the opportunity for people who might be struggling or people who might be having those problems or know someone who is struggling with substance abuse and substance misuse to say, okay, well, Now I know who to get Narcan from. Now I know how to use Narcan. Now I can teach somebody else how to use Narcan. And like, we're building this community, and we're doing it in all ways, not just in businesses. But I believe that that is how you build community, is we all have the information to care for each other.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are like, there are certain places where I've done full staff trainings, and I've talked to folks about like, here are, you know, if you are struggling with this, here are some options. You know, fentanyl testing strips are illegal to distribute through the state of Oregon. And fucking fortunately, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
Oh, sorry. Cuss. Cuss all you want.
Perfect. But they're illegal to distribute, but that does not mean that there are not websites where people can go order their own. And there are like lots of ways you can mitigate harm caused by drug consumption. And one of those ways is just to be aware of Narcan, know where it is. You know, if you know that pharmacy has Narcan, right, and you're outside or you're a couple blocks away, like, you can run over and you can let them know, like, hey, this person, I think this person is experiencing an overdose. I wanted mass accessibility, right? And where you could walk into might have Narcan.
Mm-hmm. So Narcan is the antidote to an overdose of a specific drug, or is it a bunch of drugs? Is it all opiates?
It's all opiates. Okay. It's any all opiates. So that means that the, I don't ever remember the word for it, but basically the man-made, the manufactured opiates, that would be like fentanyl, methadone, any and all opiates, Vicodin, oxycodone, things like that, heroin. So any and all opiate, it does not do anything for any other substance. So if somebody is just blacked out drunk and you, you know, make the call to Narcan them because you're not quite sure, it won't do anything to them.
Okay. No harmful side effects?
No harmful side effects. I don't have any opiates in my system right now. So if I sprayed myself, it might just taste kind of gross.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you talked about experiencing active addiction while you were still in high school. I think we've all heard enough stories, but I'm wondering how big of an issue overdose is in schools. And is Project Red, is that part of the MO, is to get into schools as well?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of work with Portland Public Schools right now, actually, to train administrators, to work with the social workers and the counselors, to work with the students as well. A lot of that stuff takes like longer planning, but we're hoping to get enough. I am hoping to get enough trainings in for as many people as wanted in the schools. I think the numbers that are being reported on are inaccurate. I think it's a far greater amount of students for Portland Public Schools. I think if you, like back in the day when I was dealing with substance use, it was so much harder to get access to like hard drugs. So it was really easy to get weed from your buddy, and it might be like kind of simple to get like some ecstasy or maybe some cocaine if you knew who to buy it from. But this access that a lot of students have now, especially like through the internet and through social media, to things like pressed pills, but no access to testing strips and no access to Narcan.
Ugh.
Or a scarier situation, especially if you have students who are dealing with, you know, substance misuse and also dealing with mental health issues.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. God bless you. What roadblocks have you encountered since Project Red's inception?
Yeah. I think the biggest one is we got a big influx of people reaching out to us. I did an interview with Eater. I did an interview with Eater. And right after that, there was kind of an influx. I think there's not a ton of word of mouth about my project, and that will come from the Willamette Week article. I just did an interview with Poach that was really fantastic. And so, I mean, eventually, like, things have to build over time, right? I've only been active since August 31st, so, I mean, my project is a baby.
Oh.
But I think the bigger one that I want to talk about is this kind of stigmatization that we have around people who consume drugs, and then also this idea that if you have Narcan on the premises of like your building, that people are more likely to come in and use said drugs, and that's just not the case. And that's not what they found in situations in other states and in other countries where they're, you know, have harm reduction practices. I think the main thing is this. Like, I always tell people, you don't have to advertise that you have Narcan. You know, I've gotten permission from the people who I've used and names that I've dropped in specific articles, because those people are open to like having people know that they want to participate in this, that they, you know, want to be known as a place that has this. A lot of places don't, and a lot of places don't want it. I mean, not a lot, but the roadblock is that places don't want it because they either are afraid of any liability issues, they don't want people to consume substances on their premises, so they don't want to be quote unquote enabling. And I always say this because I think it's true. If you have a bathroom door that locks, somebody is going to use drugs in them. That's where I would use my drugs, you know?
That's the truth. That is absolutely. Anybody who's worked in the restaurant industry can co-sign that statement. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I see this as like, it would be as necessary to have this harm reduction feature in your restaurant as it necessary like to have an EpiPen. Yeah. Just in case, like what's the difference, you know?
I believe the solution is really simple. Not everybody else sees the same way, but thankfully the feedback has been positive enough, and the people that I'm working with and the restaurants and the groups that I'm working with have been so, I mean, not excited, because I don't know that this feels like exciting work. I love my job. It still makes me nervous. And I think that the moment something stops making you nervous to do it, or you don't feel that imposter syndrome, you don't love it as much. But I think that like the feedback that I've gotten from the people who are really stoked about being able to participate in this is that they want to be part of this community. Like, I am born and raised in Portland. I remember when it used to be that you knew your neighbors and that the person standing next to you was like someone you could ask for help. Mm-hmm. And that has shifted as big cities that continue to grow and grow and have new people come in. That feeling is very different. But like, I myself am guilty of seeing a person laying down on the street, continuing to walk by without checking to see, are the beds of their fingernails like a blue, gray, purple color? Is their breathing shallow or shaky or very, very slow? Like, what if I stopped for just another second to like, you know, like that's how you build community. Like that's how we should be checking on each other. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a little off topic, but.
No, actually this segues perfectly into the question that I wanted to wrap this up with, which was, What do we, the readers, the people of Portland, need to know? And you kind of touched on that, like, I'm walking past someone, I see that they're incapacitated on the ground, and now I know that I can look at their fingernails. What am I looking for?
Yeah, you are looking for that it's going to be a purple, gray, palish, or not pale, paler skin color, purple, gray, maybe a bluish color, and not like bright purple or blue, but you'll see that under the fingernail beds and around the mouth, specifically on the lips. Any kind of, like anybody who's experiencing an opiate overdose is not conscious or aware of what's happening. So you could clap your hands, you can say or yell, I'm going to call 911, I'm going to Narcan you, just to try to get their attention. You can knock on bone, not hard, because we don't want to cause harm, but like the collarbone, the shoulder blade, rub your knuckles up and down the sternum. Basically, the biggest warning sign is this really slowed breathing. Because when someone experiences an opiate overdose, what's happening is their body is so relaxed, their brain is not actually getting, like their lungs aren't working fast enough, their brain is not getting enough oxygen. So you might hear a choking, a snoring, a gurgling sound. Basically, just check to see. If it's slower than your own breathing, that's cause to be concerned. And I always tell people, too, like, if you don't carry Narcan, rescue breathing can keep someone alive until the paramedics get there. That is a great way to, like, step in. Just if you see all of these signs and you don't know what else to do and this person is not, like, waking up when you're clapping your hands, you know, just lay them down on their back, tilt their head back, open their mouth with their chin, plug their nose. And 4 seconds inhale for yourself, 1 second exhale for them, watch their chest rise. And you can do that for minutes. You can do that until the paramedics arrive. Otherwise, if you have Narcan on them, just put it up their nose. All it needs to do is coat the mucous membrane and spray. And we should be checking on each other. You know, and it's scary. And a lot of this stuff, like we talk about this stuff, we don't acknowledge the trauma. And we don't acknowledge like, you know, I have my own experiences with opiate overdose. I've been in the presence of a couple of them. I, you know, have lost people, and I am not alone in that experience. And so I also think that, like, while we're talking about the fentanyl crisis and things like that, I think we also need to be like caring for each other, yeah. because there is so few degrees of separation between knowing someone who has passed on from an opiate overdose or someone who knows someone who has. And so we should really be caring for our community right now.
Yeah. Thanks to my guest this week, Ellen Worship, and thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Until then, bye!